We'll start then. Winter has come, and it's covering King's Landing in a gentle snow. It is a gentle snow because the winds of winter are nowhere to be found. God damn it. All right.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the 96th, can you believe it, episode of the Vassals of Kingsgrave Great Linear Song of Ice and Fire reread. My name's Bina 007 and I'm going to be your host tonight, and I am joined by Matt.
Varley on the forums.
I'm also joined by Michael.
Hey, Carl Wadeggi on the forums.
By Adam.
It's Adam Drone Snow on the forums.
By Mary.
Hey, or bonsoir, like Matt would say to me. It's now Mary on the forums.
And I think by Hannah when she's sorted out some last minute emergency. So we are back again, finally getting rid of June 300 AL. The last episode of the reread ended with Arya becoming an acolyte of Isambaro in The Ugly Little Girl on June 24th. It was the last Arya chapter, which gave me all the feels. In this episode, we're going to cover the epilogue of A Dance with Dragon, which is obviously at the end, the Iron Suitor / Victorian One, which is kind of halfway through the second paperback volume of Dance, and John 9, which is right from the beginning. So we're really bouncing around the book. And the events take place between June 28th and July 1st, 300 AL. As always, we will spoil potentially anything from the books, nothing from the show, and nothing from TWoW unless explicitly stated, and probably in the after show. And just before we get to today's chapters, to say that in June 300 AL, we got a mere 11 chapters, which already seems like a lot, but compared to some of the months like April, where there were like practically a chapter a day, we're at least moving more swiftly through the story. In June, Ramsay got married, Stannis takes Deepwood Mott, Aegon invades, Jon Con hooks up with Dawn, Quentin meets Dany, she marries his star, Tyrion and Victorian near Meereen, and Kevin is killed. So stuff is happening. This time a year ago, just a year ago in the world of A Song of Ice and Fire, in June 299, we were still in Clash of Kings.
Jesus.
Reactions. A year ago, we were still in Clash.
That's surprising.
These are the most densely plotted books of all time.
It's crazy, yeah.
And George wrapped up the action in 9 chapters. And a year ago, we had the death of Renly, Wheez, Chizik, and Barristan leaving Pentos for Karth. Renly was motherfucking alive a year ago.
That's crazy,
that's weird.
You know.
That means Stannis, like, Blackwater Bay, sulked on Dragonstone, made it north, made it south, and now is in the Mountain Clans in a year.
I mean, just logistically, that's quite impressive.
Right?
His troops must be exhausted. I was listening to the previous episode.
Yeah, Hannibal would be jealous.
Yeah. You know, Napoleonic Wars. I mean, you know, these things take decades, these campaigns. They don't happen in a year. But anyway, I felt kind of dispirited knowing that a year ago we were in Clash. So we could be a year from now and finish the series. I mean, this whole series could be like 18 months.
For 36 years of writing?
Matt, it's too early in the call. Again, just wait for the end to be.
I'm sorry.
Wait until my opening lines of my recap, Marie.
I feel like I opened the door on this one. Open the door to melancholy.
But Pina, what does that mean, though, for the 5-year gap? Like, where would that have come in?
Well, I guess 5 years hence. I don't know, because the 5-year gap would have been somewhere in the middle, right? So, but it just goes to show the problems he's having, because by choosing to write in such intense time density, I don't know how you call it, it means that no one ages. And it also means that things like Jaime or Theon going on a redemption arc is quite quick in a way. Like, most people's characters don't change that quickly. But yeah. Anyway, Hannah, lovely to have you on. Do you want to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Oh, God. Shit show shadow baby here. How are you?
Are you okay, my lovely?
Oh, God. Honestly, it's been hot red chaos since I woke up 7 minutes ago.
Okay. Well, feel free to go and get yourself a cup of coffee at some point. And or vodka. Okay, so after Arya 2, The Ugly Little Girl, we skip to the epilogue. This takes place on June 28th, and it is Vali Movali with the epic chapter summary of a chapter that's bizarrely only 17 pages long, but seems to have literally everything in it. So good luck, my friend.
All right. Well, we'll start then. Winter has come, and it's covering King's Landing in a gentle snow. It is a gentle snow because the winds of winter are nowhere to be found. God damn it. All right. We are reminded that words are won by Kevin as Ronnie Connington is pledging his loyalty, saying that he will root out his cousin from the roost. And there's some debate over whether that's really John Connington or not. Varley thinks this Tarly doth protest too much, saying he keeps on questioning whether there really is a Fagon or Targaryen or John Connington. We see Mace's new chair that's in the shape of a hand, which is absurd. We actually get verification that maybe Cersei wasn't so paranoid about Mace, because Kevin kind of confirms that he is really grabby for power. Grabby for power. So we talk about the trials. Marjorie Tyrell will be tried by the Faith, and Mace is confident that she will win. And there's a little line that said, well, yeah, because you brought your army and Tarly's army to the city to make sure she wins. Cersei will do trial by combat with Sir Robert Strong. And the internal monologue of Kevin suggests that everyone kind of knows who he is, but no one's really willing to say. But that he is vouched for by Qyburn as being a knight. He also doesn't eat or shit, so there's more information about him. They talk about how Cersei's been declawed, her followers have been sent away, and new people have been put to take care of her, and she will be going back to Casterly Rock. Pycelle, for some reason, fears that Mace will attack him and ask for more guards. This would have been a good thing to give him, maybe, even though we'll find that, you know, the spider has other ways besides the main door of getting into areas. We learn that Cersei is really subdued. She's bathing 4 to 5 times a day with heavy soap. And Kevin even has a little creepy reminder of how she was beautiful in her youth, and it's a little off-putting. We get a little background on the Tytos Lannister story about his mistress and how she never recovered from her walk of shame, and whether or not Cersei will recover from hers. Then Kevin sits down to dinner with Cersei, and Tommen is just adorable. Cersei wants Taena Merryweather back, and Kevin doesn't see any problem with that request. And I'm wondering, what's that all about? She knows that Taena and her husband, like, fucked off as soon as shit went down.
Revenge.
The Kettle Blacks have all been arrested, and this kind of takes Cersei off guard, and she's like, why? And it's like, well, you admit to banging all of them, you dummy. And so then a child comes in and says that Pycelle needs to see Sir Kevin immediately. And then we see kind of George's horror writing as he's walking slowly into the snow and into the cold. He goes to Pycelle's rookery, and it's dark and cold, and what should be in there but a white raven? At Brett, hashtag Brett. And he's immediately shot with a quarrel. Varys tells him why he's killing Sir Kevin, which now I feel like nullifies any of this Fagon theory. Like, why would he lie? It's Aegon. It's the kid. And then the children slowly kill him. And that's it.
So do you think Aegon Fagon is actually Aegon?
I do, because it's like, why would Varys lie in this very last part where he knows this person's going to die? There's no way that lying and manipulating him will advance him at all, right? Advance his cause.
Does he lie? Because he says, no, he's here, which is very ambiguous. Technically, there is an Aegon that is here in Westeros.
And I think he's the one that's, you know, marching on Storm's End. So I have a couple of theories coming from this. I think that Tarly is obviously, he's protesting too much about how it's not real Aegon and it's not real John Connington. I think there's something there, especially when they say that they have friends in the Riverlands. So whoever came up with that theory, I like it even more after reading this. I also think that Beware the Perfume Seneschal is actually Garth the Gross, who's the Seneschal of Highgarden and will be probably Master of Coin by the time this is all done. Anyone want to comment on either of those?
I feel that from a story perspective, Randall Tarly has to go back to the Reach and have conversations and confrontations with his son. And if he is Aegon's man, then his fate seems to be tied to King's Landing. So just for that reason, I don't think he is a secret agent or whatever.
You don't think him and Mace are really still pro-Targaryens?
Maybe Mace, but I think Mace is very firmly in the Lannister camp now that his daughter is married and stuff, and they're just willing to be over the Targaryens.
Yeah, I think he's kind of too stupid to be really in the Targaryen camp, to have been for like 20 years. Nope.
Yeah, I don't think he's stupid, but, though. I think he's quite canny. Because he's been able to survive.
Like he's positioned the gold cloaks like so that like
yeah
if
yeah
happens,
but that's
he's
not
in charge
like that's not rocket science, like it's the basics.
No,
you put your own men around you. It's just he's not exactly stupid, but the hand thrown, that's strikes
symbols
me
have power, you know.
Yeah.
But also think about the fact that, like, he's done it to the point where Kevin feels like he can't counter him, right? Like, he feels like he can't put his men in these key positions because all of his men are still in the Westerlands, which is kind of weird for the, you know, the Lord Regent.
Yeah, but I feel like that's more Cersei's fault than really Mace Tyrell's cunning,
yeah.
You know? He's not that stupid, but he's... I wouldn't see him as this Doran Martell kind of mastermind thing where he's been hoping for the Targaryens to come back for all this time, you know.
Well, this isn't really a show spoiler, Marie, but like the show made him out to be a buffoon. And I feel like he's completely different in the books. I think he's more politically canny, sure. Mm-hmm. He's audacious and, you know.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm going for, is that like the show made him out to be just a complete clown, and he's a little more capable than that. Like, he's not like Tywin or anything, but
that's funny, because to me he is kind of an idiot, and I didn't see him in the shows, so it's not coming from there. Just the hand thrown, I mean, I know symbols, right, but it's like what why would you
I mean, that'd be as stupid as like having someone in power that like gilds everything in gold and like, you know, is gaudy like that. You know, that's unacceptable.
But yeah, I'm with you, Mary. Like, you see in this chapter, he's like, oh, the king should declare Margaery to be innocent. And it's like, no, that's terrible PR. That's like,
yeah.
We have
I mean,
a
he's
problem.
Sitting in a hand, he's sitting in a carved hand. So
I think
I
really like,
you know
the
what
image
I mean?
Of
like, he may
hand,
not be a
like,
buffoon, but he became hand yeah, king, very... and he commissioned a chair to be made in the shape of a hand. This is the
no,
sort of
he had it before,
he did
and
it,
he
yes,
was
he had
waiting
it
for that.
Oh
like,
god,
as
that's
soon
even
that,
worse.
Is that
even
much worse than the chain of hands that Tyrion had, though? Like, as far as gaudiness.
Oh yeah, it's worse.
No, I didn't.
Well, I don't know. Only a few people see one of them.
Certainly bigger.
I had this chair in storage just waiting for the right time, you know.
I picture that the chair that he's commissioned has the a clenched fist with the middle finger standing straight up. That'd be great.
Yeah, I think I've actually seen these like chairs made out of molded plastic at like Urban Outfitters or something. Like the little cupped hand.
Pure one.
Yeah, maybe. Do people still think it's a fake Aegon, or do they just not trust Varys? Or like, I thought it was very straightforward that like, why would he lie at this point?
Well, again, I don't think he's necessarily lying. He's saying no, he's here, and that's different from saying no, Aegon did not die. Da 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 da. It's like he's created a new narrative of sorts.
Wait, Michael. So you think Fagon is Fagon, but that. That
I think he's a fake, and that, like, obviously real Aegon is dead, but Varys is not necessarily lying. He also has his little birds around, where, for as loyal as they are, they can, you know, they can write, so they can get a message out, and I think it's just so much he is buying into this idea of him as Aegon returned king, best king ever, that to admit it is to throw the act. And I also just think either one of two scenarios are true. Either Aegon, they got really lucky, Varys and Illyrio, and Aegon's head just happened to be smashed in and couldn't be identified. Or Varys and Illyrio saw an opportunity from this smashed head and made the fake switcheroo. Well, no switcheroo, but put up a fake because they knew there was an opening.
So you're on board for this fake Aegon thing no matter what, huh?
Yeah, I'm pretty diehard. We're listening to Sarah's hands that have been preserved by Illyrio. I think this is definitely the son of Illyrio and Sarah.
But why would he have all the Targaryen coloring?
Because Sarah's from Lys, and I think it's stated she does have the Lysenny look. And Illyrio was a pretty hot guy in his youth as well, so...
Yeah, he was a little water dancer sculptor.
Yeah, they got that weirdly erotic statue of him, which is really bizarre, but yes. So I think he got good genes to look like a Targaryen.
This chapter obviously gets rid of two very... Well, one's an actual Lannister and the other one's a Lannister supporter, but what is the fallout from this going to be? Will, like, the Tyrells be able to reconcile this and move it to their advantage, or will they be seen as, like Varys says, like, you know, Cersei will think that Mace killed both of you and, you know, just create more disunion, or, I mean,
first point is that Cersei doesn't get sent back to Casterly Rock because Kevin's not alive to send her back, so she remains in place as a player with this apparent newfound modesty, which I find suspicious.
I still think she's cowed. I think she's subdued.
There's a line in this chapter when she asks Kevin, so what are you going to do with your wife, Kevin? Are you going to bring her here? And Kevin's like, nah, I'm leaving her at home. And she's like, good. Yeah.
But she's like, a woman should know her place.
Which has sort of like a double meaning. She views herself as like being a god or goddess. But yeah. I think there's the lioness is still within her. It's just waiting to come out.
I agree. That thing about getting Tyena Meriwether back, I find suspicious. I don't think she'll be uncowed. I mean, I think the Walk of Shame has to do something to you. It'll change you. But she's obviously going to be
traumatized.
She's learning how to play the game. She's playing the game. But we'll see. And actually, speculation is pointless because we won't know until we know. But I can't wait to find out.
All right. So according to a wiki of Ice and Fire, Sarah had big blue eyes and pale golden hair streaked with silver. That doesn't sound very Targaryen.
Targaryens can have blue eyes. Good Queen Alysanne had blue eyes. They're blue, or like bright blue or purple, according to the world of Ice and Fire.
But our Fagon guy has like this, like perfect Targaryen features.
He is like, I definitely agree that Illyrio Varys had to look at the baby as it was maturing and be like, okay, he's a good fit. He's a good candidate. We don't need to just find someone else. Like,
but do you know how long that takes?
Not necessarily. The baby's like skip a generation or something, right?
I mean, yeah.
You still have the genes for it.
Martin genetics. We all know about Martin genetics, but like
the seed's only strong with Baratheons.
Babies get born with their hair, which I only recently discovered. So you can be like, okay, that's silver hair. That's nice. And then you look at his eyes, obviously.
Yeah, but sometimes the baby's hair falls out and then regrows. Actually,
okay, well, maybe there was a 6-month waiting period and they were like, okay, it looks good. Proceed to phase 2.
Matt is using his newfound knowledge about baby hair and baby eyes to contradict with you.
That's right.
Yeah, you never know. Some kids come out basically bald, and other kids come out, and they're like, you know, Brad Pitt or something. You're like, where did that come from?
Yeah. Does anyone else have anything else about this chapter? I don't...
Oh my god, I have so much, but everyone else go first. Everyone else go first. I don't want to dominate
conversation. If Varys wants to implicate Tyrion, why have little kids use daggers on the body? Surely a clean crossbow death is the best frame-up.
I think that's him being genuinely kind when he says, time to make an end of it. I don't want you to suffer, Kevin. You're a good man in service to a bad cause.
Yeah.
Super creepy, though.
It is super creepy. And something that I realized on the reread is Kevin twice notices that the kids are in clothes that are way too big for them, which I thought, like, oh, did they already, like, pillage, like, Pycelle's wardrobe or something and then are just wearing his furs?
Maybe
Robert
they knocked
Strong
the...
is just like four of these kids standing on each other's shoulders.
It could be that they actually knocked out killed the original serving children and are now wearing their clothes. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, and then, I guess I had one last thing about, what's his name, Boris Blount. They say that he looks fat and sickly, and he's been the king's taste tester. And I think that it was implied that, like, maybe someone's trying to poison Tommen, but then wouldn't everyone look kind of sickly? Like, why is he the only one that looks gross?
Yeah, this also aroused my suspicion, but other people say it just sounds like diabetes is setting in, all that rich food, so...
Just gonna lose a foot pretty soon?
Yeah. Or his sword hand.
I think about Kevin's death, to me, the whole thing with the kids and the daggers and all that, it's more Martin enjoying that writing and wanting to end on that very, very creepy picture of all the little kids around Kevin killing him. I'm not sure it really makes sense story-wise, because... Yeah, I kind of agree with the kindness argument, but still, it seems to me it's a bit too much, too dramatic and theatrical. It's more for the writing than really for the story, in my opinion.
I guess you could argue that the arrow or the crossbow bolt is all anyone's going to see, and that's the thing that will be repeated across all of King's Landing. Oh, he was shot by a crossbow bolt, just like Tywin, da-da-da-da-da-da. The cuts will be less noticed. I don't know how rumors propagate, this is just my guess.
Anything else from anyone else?
Oh, me. This chapter has... We've got snow falling in King's Landing from winter, obviously. We have verified stories of Daenerys and her dragons that have made it in. And then you have fucking Gregor Clegane walking around, raised up by the dark arts, and everyone knows this but doesn't want to say it. Again, super pivotal. It feels like the three story threads are truly coalescing for the first time.
I know, it would be really cool to sort of see where that went in the next book, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I can't wait.
So, Kevin thinks that he's being summoned by Pycelle because they heard something from Stannis and the Bolton. So should the next book start off like, we're in it, we're doing the battle? Like,
well, that'll be very, very soon, given the Theon chapter that we got at the end of A Dance with Dragons that was meant to be in A Dance with Dragons, but now it's in The Winds of Winter. But I think we have been told that the prologue chapter involves Jane Westerling somehow, so I don't know.
Oh, Jesus. Meh. Hips.
Hips. Perspective of Jane's hips.
Jane Westerling. She was the one married to Rob, okay. Jane
Poole
is the one married
to.
I know. I was like, oh no, it's going to be a weird like animal dog rape scene or something with Ramsay. But no, it'll be something even worse probably.
So I thought with Kevin, he is reminiscing over quite a lot, he then tells to himself, no, I will not do this. This is what old done men do. And then he keeps on reminiscing all throughout the chapter. I was like, guy, you're not self-aware. You're doing what old men who are defeated do, which is reminisce on all the things that could have happened. It's like, if only Rhaegar had chosen Cersei. And he goes on and on and on, and he just sounds defeated, actually. Like,
well, I don't think he ever had the confidence that, I mean, obviously didn't have the confidence that Tywin had, but he's always lived in the shadow of Tywin, so he can maybe look back on, you know, decisions that were made that he would have thought otherwise, but he wasn't really at the table to make those decisions.
All the stuff he's done so far is good, and it's like, yeah, he's competent and stuff, but yeah, again, you have the shadow, the hole that Tywin has left, and Kevin can't quite fill it in his mind.
Right. Kevin is the game manager. He's like the Alex Smith. Like, he does a good job, but he's not your superstar.
He's not your franchise tag.
Right, you're constantly looking for someone better than him, but like, he does while you've got him.
Poor guy, he still thinks he could put Lancel as a white sword, and that Lancel's redeemable and will come over from the faith. We suspect that it'll be Lancel versus Robert Strong in this trial by combat.
At least Kevin doesn't have to watch that now.
Yeah.
Yeah, my thought exactly. Because that will be like a carnage.
Yeah, I mean, it's an alive person versus a zombie, right?
Yeah, but not a very strong alive person.
No. What will happen if both Cersei and Margaery are found innocent? Like, both of them can't be, right? For just the story?
I think they will, for dramatic reasons, because it elevates the tension to, like, it was already pretty bad between Cersei and Margaery. People were gossiping about it, but now it elevates the tension to this untenable level. I think during Margaery's trial, it's going to be very obvious that Cersei arranged for all this, and then both of them are found innocent, and now they're put in this very awkward position where they, like, have to be nice to each other, but, you know, underneath, and everyone can see that there's just absolute hostility, and that'll last about a chapter, and then King's Landing becomes a bloodbath.
So you think that, like, I mean, Kevin kind of describes it in the throne room, how the Tyrells are on one side, the Lannisters on the other, and, like, there's something hanging in the air that's just, like, enmity, but, like, they're putting on, like, a friendly face right now.
Yeah, and if you can just get rid of Cersei, send her off to Casterly Rock, maybe there's a chance, but now there's none.
Yeah, and especially with the murders of him and Pycelle. So who's going to be the next Pycelle, guys? Do we even know of another Archmaester besides the guy that shits himself that, what's his name, Pate had to take care of?
I'm kind of hoping that Maester Yandel, who you'll remember is the combination of Elio and Linda, and in canon, he's in King's Landing and he's got that book that he wants to give to Tommen, but he's never getting admitted. I kind of hope that he gets elevated.
Wait a minute, what? Who,
okay, so what? Maester Yandel, who okay. wrote The World of Ice and Fire.
Uh-huh.
This is inspired by Elio and Linda Garcia, right. Like it's a combination of their names or something.
Right.
And it was just some stupid invention of a maester that wrote this thing. And so canonically, he's in King's Landing, and he's got this book that he wants to give to, first it was Robert, then it was Joffrey, now it's Tommen. But he just hasn't been able to get audience time. I'm kind of hoping he is elevated as like the temporary Grand Maester, and then he dies a horrible death as well. That would just be really funny.
So in canon, I haven't read the world book in so long, but it's stated in there in like the foreword or something that
there's a spiel about his life and how he was like abandoned at Old Town and he became a Maester and all this stuff. I just thought it'd be funny to have him there, and then he's killed off horribly, and it's like a kind of a meta wink at the audience.
Yeah.
One more thing I have to say, money might be a linking theme between these three chapters. They obviously mention all the debt with the Iron Bank and how no one's giving them new loans and they're kind of screwed.
Yeah, I thought that too. I thought it was ironic that they're saying, oh, you may have to go to Braavos, and little do we know that the Braavosy banker is already at the wall trying to do a deal with Stannis. So that ship has sailed, my friends.
So when they talk about
Kevin does think, like, worst case scenario, like, Lannisters will just bail them out because they have so much. So,
yeah, do you think they'll go to Illyrio for, because they say, like, we'll go to Pentos for one of the money lenders there.
I don't think the Pentos here are going to clear the loan. They're like, this is not AAA. This is, what's the lowest thing, Bina, that you don't even rate when you
junk,
make bonds?
Junk credit.
Junk?
Yeah, this is junk credit. The Iron Bank is junk credit. Does that make sense?
Although, technically speaking, junk is still rated. There are unrated bond issues.
You can make a lot of money on junk if they actually pay it off, but that's a big game, right?
This is a bad investment. No, I don't think anyone's giving them a loan.
But then, Lannisters have so much money, why were they even borrowing from anyone but Tywin in the first place? That doesn't make sense to me.
Because Tywin, I mean, you would think he'd want them indebted, but he, I guess, didn't want to put himself at risk.
I mean, think they are actually also indebted to the Lannisters.
Yeah, but not
they were at some point.
But isn't Cersei now the Lannister heir? Like, who is now the heir of the Lannister gold?
Well, Jaime, of course, he's the man. He has a dick. He can make
white
such
cloak,
decisions.
Though. He's got a white cloak.
Yeah, so he can't inherit. So it must be Cersei, right? So she can just bail herself out, can't she?
I think the whole Lannister is like, it's complicated because it should be Cersei, but at the same time she's also queen, so that's an issue. And I'm not sure if it's been clarified by, I think it was a big issue for Tywin because he didn't want Cersei to be his heir, and he kind of had no one else because he didn't want Tyrion to be either, and he never really clarified anything before dying, so no one really knows who it is.
You know what I mean? Like, his father did shit like that, and he absolutely despised it. That's what I think it's more about, is that Tywin's like, no, that's Lannister shit. You're the queen. You're the crown. You get your own shit.
Yeah.
You don't just come, like, running to the bank of daddy whenever you need stuff. So I think I always got the feeling that it was more like just on principle alone.
Well, I think even when Tyrion's Hand of the King, he's like, well, when he becomes Master of Coin, he's like, well, the Lannisters could always forgive their debts to the crown. And Tywin's like, don't be absurd, dummy.
Right.
Yeah, it's a matter of pride. But regarding why there are multiple debts to the Iron Bank, to the Faith, I think Littlefinger may have done this purposefully. I mean, Tywin might have been unwilling to lend more than 3 million, but I think this scenario was something he was hoping might have happened in the future. Like, you can't bank on this, that they're actually going to stop paying the Iron Bank, but it's just a long shot that it could. And, you know, it destabilizes the crown.
Well, that's a good point, because, like, even Littlefinger does remark that, like, Cersei's moving faster than, like, he even thought she could fuck everything up. Like, So you might be right that he had these plans laid down and they thought it would come to fruition a little more slowly. But, you know, Cersei says, no, we're going to stop paying the Iron Bank, and then everything gets fucked up.
Well, how much does anyone know the exact amount of their debt to the Iron Bank?
It's between 1 and 2 million dragons, because we know 3 million to the Lannisters, almost 1 million to the Faith. And then the rest of it is divided between the Iron Bank, a little bit to House Tyrell, and some Myrish cartels.
And if you win a tourney, that's like 8 million.
No, it's like 100,000 to the winner for the tourney. I can't remember these money figures, but I just assume that the lion's share of that 1 to 2 million dragons is to the Iron Bank.
Lion's share, like Lannisters. I love it. Good pun, Michael.
I just like the lion's share. It's applicable.
It's also really good knowledge on the finances, just to have at your fingertips.
Bina, I am down to do the finance podcast with you whenever you're ready.
Maybe when the reread's over.
You can't, like, bring your personal stuff to work, and you're not supposed to spend your money on stuff for work, so I don't know how much it would translate to Westerosi logic, but maybe Tywin also just has that, like, where you don't get petty cash from a coworker. You know what I mean? Like, that's not how finances do work. Can't just like come up with money from wherever. So they might have laws against who you can and cannot borrow from. Or the crown, not like your own personal household, because they could use Lannister gold for their own personal household, but to fund things for the state, I don't know if they're legally allowed to do that.
Yeah, but they don't.
Well, especially
they don't have laws.
It's just not a smart idea.
Yeah,
like he has no sort of like angle on the Lannisters becoming the crown until Robert's dead. So like, why keep giving to someone that it just keeps going into the red?
Right.
So like he wanted to, like, you know, I mean, for all he knew, Robert was going to live 20 more years, and, you know, he could have bankrupted the Lannisters if he was the one, but, you know, I don't know.
Right. So. And I guess like he would never give it to Tyrion, and Cersei technically couldn't inherit it because she'd be married off again anyway. That was his plan. And then Jaime can't inherit it. So he might have just wanted to keep it in house.
Yeah, I think it's deliberately meant to be an unspoken gray area, because, again, Tywin's an idiot, and he didn't plan for this, and I think Tywin's an idiot.
Ooh, controversial.
Well, I agree
Hot
with...
Hot take, episode title, Tywin's an idiot.
Over at Not a Podcast, where they say, beneath what he puts out as his appearance, he is a very emotional and irrational person.
That's true.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's an idiot, though. He seems more shrewd than just, like, an idiot. An ass, for sure. Kind of like me.
No, not at all. Right. Anything else in this chapter? Okay, right. Let's rock and roll then. So, after the epilogue, we skip to the Iron Suitor / Victorian One. I'm sure we all get very excited about a Victorian chapter.
So,
which takes place 2 days later on June 30th. The chapter is the third Victorian chapter in Feast Dance and the first of two in Dance. It's about 150 pages prior to the epilogue in the published order.
Why? Should the epilogue be like literally the last thing? I mean, even in this linear reread, like, I don't...
No, because linear reread just is when the dates fall, so... It's just that George doesn't really have much grasp of when shit occurs in his own books, though.
Yeah.
Well, and especially, isn't that like the tail end of Dance sort of stuff where he got so excited, he just kind of kept writing? And you get like people that come back from Feast and all that. Yeah.
It's very strange now that we are done for King's Landing. Like, yeah.
Conspiracy theory, that's what's taking so long with Wins. George is actually doing this linear reread with us to get all his bullshit in order. So
we said, as soon as we finish, he'll announce. We know it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
per Hannah, we need to finish, then he needs to write, then he'll announce.
Yeah. You know, backup recorder is actually George listening to each podcast.
Anywho, so
I can neither confirm nor deny that.
So on to the Victorian chapter. Who's summarizing this? Is it Michael or Hannah?
I have it.
Lovely. Off you go.
Okay. The Iron Fleet is anchored by the Isle of Cedars and is infested with monkeys. Victorian doesn't like the monkeys because he is an idiot and he thinks the monkeys are laughing at him when they chitter. Also, because Victorian is an idiot, he didn't treat his wound properly after the Battle of the Shields, which is now starting to fester.
Poison.
Maester is trying to treat the wound with limited success as Victorian waits for the remaining Iron Fleet to arrive, having been split up three ways to better reach Meereen. Volantis has launched launched its fleet against Marine after the new election, and Victarion knows he cannot wait much longer. Victarion has no problems confiding all of this and his secrets to the mute, dusky woman, even though he once belonged to Euron, and tells of his plans to take Daenerys as his own bride. The 54th ship, named Grief, arrives, carrying a mysterious wizard, the Red Priest Mokoro, who has foreseen Victarion and his impending death. The crew call for him to be killed, but Mokoro has zero fucks to give, prompting Victarion to take him below decks. That afternoon, the crew hear a deep and terrifying laughter, and then a strange singing in High Valyrian. All the monkeys clamber off the ship to let us know that the fun times are over, but just when things are getting too serious, Victarion comes out with what can only be described as a volcano arm, the spawner of thousands of Lightbringer and Azor Ahai theories, all centered around Victarion. He tells the crew to slit the maester's throat and throw him into the sea, which will give them favorable winds to Marine.
Very good.
So this is our favorite idiot, Victarion.
And maybe our most prescient and accurate prophesier in the novels to date, Mokoro.
Mokoro knows his shit.
He knows
his prophecies.
Shit. I mean, he's good. He has pinpoint accuracy with forecasts. But I have...
It's amazingly satisfying to have a Red Priest that gets it right. I don't know why.
Do you think he's getting it right by the same magics that other Red Priests use? Or given they're all a bit shit, does he have his own special something going on?
Well, I don't think they're all shit. I mean, Melisandre has made fuck-ups before, but overall she can see it better than... I can.
Maybe with Melisandre, her scope is a lot greater. Like, she's foretelling the end of the world and waking the stone dragons and all that crap. So she's got a higher error rate, whereas Mokoro's visions seem to be centered around Victarion. So maybe that's why he can get things a bit more accurate.
So there are macro and micro prophecy?
Oh, absolutely.
Are there meso prophecies too?
Yes.
Facetiousness aside.
Well, Michael doesn't sound like he understands what meso-prophecy is, so why don't you explain that to him, Kina?
Yeah, I need it.
The shit in the middle. Okay.
Yeah, it's the name of the shit. Between micro and macro, you have the meso term.
Indeed.
At least we're doing physics.
So is that the same thing as when you're cooking, you put your mise en place and get all your things in the order and separated and ready to cook?
No.
Okay. Look at me trying to sound smart.
Right. Who poisoned the cart? Who poisoned the cart? The dusky woman? The maester?
Oh, clearly.
Do we even care? Or is it just
Victarion
being a fool?
Stupid. He was like, I'll put some vinegar on it.
I'm not... Yeah, Victarion is stupid, but maybe it's also being poisoned, but definitely not by the maester. Like, and it's even when Victarion is thinking that it might be the maester, is like, because after all, Euron gave him to me. And I'm like, well, he also gave the dusky woman to you. So
I think
that
he tells this the dusky woman. Like, he's so stupid.
And like, the maester is just a poor guy who's not equipped to survive in the Iron Man world. And he's just like, yeah, poor guy. He's just frightened and is trying to do the thing he knows, which are saving this guy's hand, and obviously he fails, but he's not poisoning him.
Yeah, I feel sorry for that maester.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of shit happens to him in this chapter. It's yeah. Ugh.
Well, isn't he sodomized?
Yeah. Or...
By four
right.
men.
Yeah.
And he lost four of his teeth as well because someone punched him for smiling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a lot of misery.
Well, the Iron Islanders are just miserable fucks anyway, so what do you expect?
So this was the chapter I didn't get to this morning. They're in the broken arm, right? In the Stepstones? Is that what this is?
No, they're in the Isle of Cedars, which is really close to Slaver's Bay.
Right.
And actually, there was a really nice world-building detail about when the Doom of Valyria came, there was this massive tidal wave, and it, like, completely wiped out this island, and no cedars grow here anymore, apparently.
So he gets that cut in the chapter before this one, or in this chapter?
By, what's his name, the Sari guy in the...
Talbot Sari.
Yeah. That guy seemed pretty badass. Even Victarion.
Yeah,
like,
that's
that
what I always
a worthy opponent.
It was like his blade was poisoned or something. You know how people would like rub their feces and shit so you get an infection?
I don't think so. I think it was above board. It was too good for that.
This actually reminds me a bit of Hannibal, like, where was it?
Like
Hannibal?
In The Politician.
One of those who died of a bloody nose and it like clotted up his face or something while going through the Alps.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Some. Damn, I shouldn't try to drop a knowledge bomb when I don't know what I'm talking about. But some great warlord, one of the
Huns. I feel
like
either Nadia or Jacques would have known exactly what you were talking about.
He was marching to sack Rome, but then he got a very minor wound and it festered and killed him.
Almeric?
Yeah, him. Let's go with him.
Okay, I think he was the Vandals, right?
I thought you were going to say he was a vampire.
Oh, he might have been a vampire. Who knows? I wasn't there.
But it does remind me of just, yeah, a little minor wound that no one thought was any big deal, and now it's obviously become a very big deal. Victorian's got, like, gangrene or whatever that's about to develop.
It's like the CIA giving Bob Marley cancer in his toe.
Well, he's such a dipshit. I mean, he's probably like, oh, my hand is cut, but we don't have any toilet paper. You know, he probably inadvertently did it to himself. It's a little bit different than Drogo's cut, I think.
Well, no, Drogo was a fucking idiot, too, because it wasn't he like, take off the poultice, like, let it breathe, I'll put cow shit in it or something. And so Victorian has this lava arm now. What's he going to do with it? Is it going to be like a Hellboy kind of style? Like,
oh, God.
Just punching people, or...
Of all the this people is so to give Bina, it's uncontrollable fire
oh,
to.
And Bina, if you can isolate whatever podcast that Peter was on where he's like, he's got a volcano arm.
Yeah, color me so unexcited about this, about Victorian as a character
Victorian
in general.
King.
Oh, he's just so appalling. He's just, oh. And people who get
all
excited.
He has going for him is he's a good fighter.
I mean, yeah.
The best we can hope for is, like, he and Euron just fight each other to the death and they both die.
It's just, like, I mean, the Greyjoys really are just unredeemably shit, aren't they?
Yeah. Most of the Iron Islanders. I mean, they fucking stood in a seal for
Asha.
Asha. They used a fucking seal as a wedding. Like, come on.
Yeah, but she is the only cool one. She's the one that's, like, ready to change
her
shit
and
up.
Roderick the Reader. I'm like, yeah, cool. I'm good with them.
The only purpose of Victorian really is to deliver the dragon binding horn to whomever for whomever it's going to be used for, right?
Yes,
he's just a plot delivery device.
And then he'll
be long for this world.
Yeah, because he's dumb enough to blow it, right? I mean,
I don't think he is, or else he would have already done that, right?
Well, you need to be like right next to the dragon before you blow it, I think. Because they blew it in the Iron Islands, and it obviously didn't bring the dragons all the way over. I think in the Winds of Winter, which is just around the corner, the science of how the dragon binding horn works will be demonstrated.
Okay, can I ask a question?
Yep.
The fuck's up with the lava arm? It's like in the John chapter, the fucking crow. You always forget about these, like, random magics that aren't, like, really like the talking gate at the wall.
Well, again, we have more and more magic entering into the story. I actually do wonder if this has any special properties or if it's just a regular arm that's been fire bleached.
Oh, do you think it's like oozy?
No, it says in this chapter that it's like charred and smoking. So it makes me feel like this is like what Makoro had to do to save the arm, but now it's like it's like a fire white arm.
Guys, what if Makoro goes up above the wall and punches the other in the face with his firearm?
Well, then he's Azor Ahai, and the arm is Lightbringer.
God damn it.
Oh, God, I think we need to move away from this chapter to the next chapter at this point.
Victorian's redemption could be he
salt
goes
and smoke,
up
baby.
Punches.
And then he marries Dany and rules the world, the end.
Well, you're starting to sound like Patrick, collectively. Not the prince who was promised.
No, I got it. He's going to go to Old Valyria, find Iron Man's suit, become Iron Man, save the world, done. Mic drop, we're out.
Who's Iron Man?
Please, no.
It just happened.
Right. I'm officially moving us to the next chapter unless anyone has an indispensable to
say. Can I just say one more thing? Sorry.
About
this is the
chapter.
Last intelligent thing I have to say. The sound of this...
We still have one more chapter to go, Michael.
The sound of this ritual seems very similar to what Miri Mazdua does. Like, there's singing, there's dancing, there's weird shadow stuff. So I think, again, it's all the same magic. And obviously, Miri Mazdul was not a red priest, but I think it's, yeah, it's the same shit.
But that was kind of the point I was trying to make earlier, which is the red priests don't really have a good track record for us. The people who've actually done magic that has worked, even if it's for their own nefarious ends, is Miri Mazdul and now Macquarie. So it seems to me more that their magics will come from something different, even if he claims to be a red priest, that there will be something darker, deeper
we're
going on with him.
Thoros of Mir,
yeah,
who's revived.
I was about to say, yeah.
That's some powerful fucking magic right there. Come on.
Now they put Catelyn as Lady Stoneheart. That's great.
Yeah, you revive someone by proxy. That's fucking strong shit.
Yeah, that's true.
But I do agree, Beaner, there is a dark tinge to all of this. Like, it's clearly blood magic or whatever.
Well, isn't it, magic is a sword without a handle or whatever? Like, there's always, like, some back-end damage being done, but...
Still, yeah, Victorian's arm.
Not really a red priest. Like, didn't he only join the faith after he got those magic powers?
Yeah, he was a lapsed Catholic that regained his faith.
Right. He liked drinking.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, let's go. Let's move on.
Victorian, I have to say, the first chapter in this reread, I loved it so much. And then you get to a Victorian one, and you're just like, I don't know. And Macquarie is cool. Don't get me wrong, Macquarie is very cool, but Victorian just annoys me the fuck off. Okay. So anyway, after the Iron Suitor, we skip back 18 chapters to John 3, which is the third chapter in the second half of the book. It takes place the next day on July the 1st. We're in July, everyone. This is 200 pages earlier in the published order, so we really have moved around the book. And I believe it's Hannah. Geez. Yeah, I know. It really is bonkers. So it's Hannah with a chapter summary.
Okay, so I actually have to give credit to Monroe Jacques, too, for helping me write most of this, because he's a very special friend. Okay, so on today's very special episode of Welcome Back, Cotter Pike, Selyse and her queen.
Oh, boy. Oh, God.
Oh, brilliant.
Selyse and her
all the effort went into that.
Selyse and her queen's men come busting through the wall like the purple Kool-Aid man, and they're ready to do some converting, y'all. After John gets rid of her, he starts gossiping. From the gossip, he finds that the Iron Bank are changing their support from Tommen to Stannis. John then leverages his resources to extort 3 ships and gold from the banker, Tycho. Then he thinks that his expedition to Hardhome is undersupplied, but fuck it, I'm Jonny Snow. And if there's one thing I know, it's engaging in a land war in winter is always a good idea. Then he wonders if Mother Mole and her people will be desperate enough to commit to the rescue effort, in quotes. After further gossip, John finds out about queer dragons. And then in parentheses, he wrote a great name for a pub. I agree. I think we should open it, coming right after Winds of Winter. Then he broods over his own decisions for most of the chapter before being rudely interrupted by Alice Karstark on a horse escaping from her uncle slash pimp. And then at the end, he wrote... and I guess I have to sing it. Feel my serpentine. Ooh, I want to hear you scream. Quote, Axel Rose Florence Bell. That was his note. The end.
I love the ending of this chapter with Elise Karstark saying, help me, Jon Snow. You're my only hope. Star Wars all the way. All the way.
100%. Yeah. Even I wrote that on my notes. This is Princess Leia to the T. Yeah. I think it's so ironic in this chapter and kind of heartbreaking that John's so excited it might be Arya and thinks she's going to need protecting. Where can I send her? Maybe I'll send her to Braavos, not realizing as we do that she's already there and does not need protecting because she's an evil little psycho killer already. It's only a year, right, since Clash, and he still has this image of her as she was, and she's just moved so far away from that. It's petrifying.
So... I remember like reading this for the first time and thinking, oh my God, like this is where did Arya come back? And like, this is where they meet up again. Like if that ever happens in the books, it's going to be like, so I'm going to like lose my mind. Like just the anticipation of it. Like the first time I was like, and now rereading, of course, you know that it's not Arya, but like, you know, I don't know. It stirred some emotions in me. I'll say.
You were as excited as John was.
Yeah. A little giddy. Aww. Starks are putting the band back together.
Bless.
Yeah.
I'd completely forgotten the whole Karstark reveal and plot. It's so long since I've read V-Stance before. I was like, oh my God, this is actually kind of cool.
I don't know what you all think about John's actions in Dance, But I'm really convinced that, well, we judge it all by the fact that he ended up being murdered, which, yeah, is not a good outcome. But I...
it's probably the worst outcome.
Yeah. But I actually, I remember reading these and being all for it and all, like, thinking that he's actually doing good. He's not in the best position, and that's tough. But I thought that he's doing good. It's just it doesn't end well. But I think we judge him too harshly for all of his actions in dance.
Were you therefore surprised when he was killed, because you thought he was doing better and were therefore surprised that people had taken so violently against him?
Yeah.
Well, like this deal with the bank, I think he says it. It's like, well, we might go bankrupt, but at least we'll live. We won't starve to death during the winter. Like, this is a good move. He makes bad political moves and bad strategic, like, divisions by, like, moving all his supporters away from him.
Yeah.
But, like, this is also a solid move. Like, this is a good
and he's trying to see on the long-term thing. Like, he's trying to save the world. That might be a bit too ambitious, but he makes bad political moves, but overall he's trying to do the right thing, and he's not that stupid. It's not just, I'm going to save everyone. He's trying to do it well.
But the seeds of his downfall are in this chapter when, you know, I mean, it is kind of funny when Queen Sleaze is sort of shocked to see 1-1 wandering, but...
Oh, what a bitch she is. Huh?
But the point is valid, right? That this is why he's going to get killed, because he takes the wildlings in his shelter who've been the enemy for so long. So... I mean, I don't disagree with him. I think the tragedy of John is he dies because he tries to do the right thing by everyone and to be truly fair and to live up to the kind of the mantra of the Night's Watch. But he totally overestimates other people's flexibility and ability to see things his way. Like, he doesn't take into account human nature and pettiness. Right. And if you can't do that as a leader, I mean, a leader is ultimately... It's an HR position, right? You're managing people for better or worse. You can't pretend that their flaws don't exist. So I think whenever I read a chapter like this, in this moment when Sleaze is saying, you know, so who are you going to take in as hospitality? Like, I'm just like... They have a point, John. They have a point.
Well, isn't that like the problem with like economics and the problem with that economists have, that they always assume that people will go in their best interest and what works best for them? And you see it here where it's like, okay, this isn't hurting you, and this is helping other people that will be allies in the future, but like they can't see beyond. They can't see the big picture like John is trying to.
But it's not irrational. Well, like, if you've been enemies with someone, like the wildlings have been your enemies.
But they're the Reach. The people of the Reach haven't been fighting on the wall. Like, you know?
Yeah, but it's still like, I haven't personally been fighting like the French, but, you know, I know that we've been fighting them for thousands of years, and inevitably it will happen again.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Bonjour, no, but you know what I mean? Like, inherited prejudice is very hard to overthrow. And John is like this wonderful rational humanist. I mean, he really is a very specific creature ethically. And it's something that's so alien as a philosophy to these books and the people in them. And he just blithely goes around thinking, but it's so obvious to me that X equals 4 and no one else gets it. And he just doesn't make any allowances for that. And it's not that he's wrong, it's just that he's too ambitious given the people he's working with.
Yeah, bad presentation and an inability to make any compromises. That's what dooms
politics. Is nothing if you don't bring people with you. I mean, you can have all the right ideas in the world, but if you cannot convince, then what's it worth? I mean, no wonder he ends up dead.
Jesus.
Some people have said he's a really good strategist, but a bad politician.
He is a bad
John
politician.
Knows leadership style.
Yeah, 100%.
I think what's sad about this is, I mean, you said it, Matt. He sent everyone who had his back away, but he did manage to get elected. So even if it was mostly not to elect someone else, he's not such a bad leader. Some people did choose to follow him, and they were quite loyal to him, but not enough, and he sent them away, which was actually really stupid.
Yeah, I think that's what makes it as the saddest, is like, there was a way he could have made this work, but he clearly didn't. He didn't please the right people, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that, I mean, this is going back a little bit, but I think his biggest mistake was not just taking Stannis' offer. It was like some kind of bastard bullshit pride that he had when he could have been like the Stark in Winterfell.
Really? I would say he made the smart decision.
Really?
Yeah, let's debate.
Oh! Come on!
No,
let me get another drink.
If he breaks that, people will forever call him an oath breaker, and he's got no honor. And no, that his word would be totally worthless.
We have so much evidence in the society that people do not forgive you going back on your word. He himself in this chapter
especially
is making
in
digs
the North,
about guests,
work.
Right? I mean, he's making digs about, you know, people being your guests and bad things happening to you. So even he's the same. This is a world in which people remember shit.
The North people would say
the only way it could work where he becomes the Stark is if the North demands it, basically forces him into it, not Stannis.
Well, I think that's what Stannis is basically using the whole Stark clause to get the mountain people. What are they called?
Mountain clans.
Like on his side, and that's their whole motivation. It's like, oh, we have to save the Ned's little girl, and like, so if they actually had a Stark figurehead in front of that army, I think everything would have come together and coalesced. It would be like
no,
Sack
but I mean,
and Winterfell.
Right figurehead is the right word there, Matt, because like, how is the North going to react to like this king from the south is up here and oh look, he's taken Ned Stark's bastard and he's using him against us. He's weaponizing this kid versus like the mountain clans and the rest of the northern houses saying we demand Jon. You know, that would work, but not through Stannis like in any way.
I think short term it may have worked just because everyone hates the Boltons so much, but long term, once you're settling down, people are like, hey, John, you were sworn to the Night's Watch. Like, that's kind of bad. Like,
yeah, but the defense there is that
this is our lord.
Is that the king pardoned you? Like, that can happen.
Right, but they already like broke off from the Seven Kingdoms, right? They already were like, fuck the king from the south.
Well, no, because the North already said, oh, we're back part of the Seven Kingdoms. Roose Bolton's our new warden of the North. You know, we're...
Well, yeah, because they had no choice. They all clearly hate that. Like, 10 years from now, let's say Bolton's still in power. How well do you think that's going?
Oh.
The only other person who's wanted to pardon men of the Night's Watch is Cersei. I'll just leave it at that.
Jesus, I forgot about that.
Yeah, she had a great idea. Oh, the Kettle Blacks can then come back. And it's like, Cersei, you're crazy.
Queen Alysanne didn't do anything like that?
No, she just let them stay there.
Yeah, she gave the gift, but that's all.
Gotta respect your institutions, you know?
Not when they're old and outdated and...
I mean, you are right. The Night's Watch is full of crap, but it's just like the guest right. You don't break it.
Or do you? Because the phrase seemed to have prospered from their breaking of the guest, right? Right?
I'm not sure I would agree with that. they're getting killed by...
There's like 1,000 of them. Like, we know that, yeah, like, three were hung.
Yeah, but everyone hates them. Like, they're getting killed, they're getting eaten. I mean, it's not a good outcome either.
Oh, like murder? It's
yeah.
not the best.
Yeah, so when their house is wiped out within, like, a year or two or whatever of the Red Wedding, like, it's going to be even more... devastating, because you're like, there were 1,000 of them. They're like, yeah, and they're all gone.
Yeah, but right now they're living on, you know, what's his name? Walder Frey is like, you know, king of the Riverlands or whatever the fuck his title is.
Yeah, Tywin's gone, Joffrey's gone. Like, I don't know. They've bet on the wrong horse. It's already kind of falling apart.
Yeah, I'm not betting on the Freys. They're not getting any of my money. They're also a bad investment.
No, they're good for short sell.
And I mean, I would take shares in the Twins for sure, because that's going to always make money.
Let's talk more about investing in Westeros.
I do have something money-related that I want to talk about. Ooh. Relating to this chapter. So, as Jon says in his mind, Stannis has now won this like treasure trove of gold that he can just dig into and buy 100 sellsword companies, bribe all the lords, do whatever he wants, basically. And I just thought that was really interesting, because it sounds a lot like a sunken cost fallacy for the Iron Bank. And I do know that, like, their reputation of getting their loans back is more important. But if I had already invested, like, 1 million dragons, and then I have to give, like, how many more dragons does he have to give to Stannis on the hope that Stannis will succeed, who's not the fastest horse in this race? Bad investment.
So don't you think it's just a, oh, what the fuck do they call it? When you buy a stock at like $10 and it drops to $5, so you buy the equal amount to normalize your loss. Ina, help me out. What is that?
Yeah, sunk cost fallacy is basically continuing. Amount. It's continuing. It's a behavioral economics concept, right? So it's just continuing any course of action, even though it's not working for you, hoping that it will then turn around. Like it's not wanting to admit and cut your losses and run.
Right.
It's hoping.
It's like me with GE or Chesapeake gas stock.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but it's not about necessarily like investing the same amount to keep yourself equal. It's just continuing.
But it's like doubling down is like in Boiler Room where he's like, they're selling the junk stocks and he's like, right, but it's become a gold stock. Now it's half the price. So if you buy twice as much, your price goes down for what you paid for everything. And like, it'll be great, right? When it pays off. Like, no, it won't.
Throwing good money after bad. It's just a posh way of saying that. Most economics is just posh ways of saying common sense shit.
Yeah. So do you think the Northern Lords could be bought now that winter is upon them? I feel like this is a very vulnerable time and that it would work for Stannis if he, like, offers them a shit ton of gold that they can use to, like, you know, truck up some food from the south or from overseas or whatever. Like, I think that would work.
I could see them doing it temporarily, like sort of like playing nice just to get the money and survive, a bit like John, and then they'll deal with it. They'll deal with him come spring.
Right.
I don't think it fundamentally changes their vengeance seeking loyalties, but you could see people in desperation of hunger doing what John did. Like, he's going to drop his pants and take whatever terms the Iron Bank gives because he needs to feed his peeps.
Are you saying that he got Victorian maestered?
It's just a phrase we use in fund management. Drop your trousers. Like when people are kind of like trying to kill you on fees, just drop your trousers and take the fee cut. Because you want.
Close your eyes and think of the Queen.
Close your eyes and think of England.
But yeah, in this chapter, like I understand the Iron Bank is obviously the most respected financial institution, but it's just funny that they make two really bad deals in this chapter.
Well, isn't why is the deal with John a bad deal? Hedge bets, right?
Because, well, the Iron, not the Iron, the Night's Watch can't repay this. Like,
why not?
The best hope would be, like, you hope Stannis takes the throne, and then it's like, hey, Stannis, can you pay this for us?
If the war, if they don't die of starvation, because this troubled me. I was like, how do the Night's Watch repay loans? What's their revenue? But remember, they do have the gift. They have lands that have been given to them that generate crops and wealth that they can use to repay. So as long as you get to spring, I think there is a chance they can repay the loan. And also, they're politically neutral. Like, whoever wins this war, the Watch is still going to exist. So actually, I think it's a good loan. I think it's a good loan for the Iron Bank. The Iron Bank, like, who is going to 100% exist after this civil war is over? Maybe Cersei, maybe Stannis. 100% the Night's Watch.
Right. And they could charge whatever interest they know because the Night's Watch will continue to exist. Like, they might not realize their entire loan, like, in a couple of years, but they may, over the next century, get paid back, you know, double of what they lent.
Yeah. So I think the Night's Watch is good credit, actually. I think they're, like, you know, to me, they're the ultra-safe borrower.
Plus, in the
war, the Iron Bank can't suspect, like, the wall will fall or anything to do with the others. They don't know anything about any of that. They're just looking at what's going on in Westeros, and the Night's Watch just kind of hangs out forever up north.
For all they know, that now that they have common cause with the wildlings, like, they can exploit the natural resources above the wall.
They drill, baby, drill. In the north.
Happy days.
Yeah, there's got to be some mineral wealth up there. Anyway.
You get to see the Florence in this chapter. They're a bunch of assholes.
Yeah, with big ears.
George is really, really laying on the visual imagery of, like, this guy's a dunce. This guy's an... Ugh.
We know that Sir Patrick is a douchebag, too. And he gets what's coming to him.
What was he thinking? To approach a giant with his sword, like, which he'll do in the however many chapters to try and kill it. Like, idiot.
Yeah.
A southern fool, as John thinks.
Yeah. But he has, like, a chance to kill a giant and then, you know, make a name for himself.
He'll be in the songs.
Yeah. Even though, didn't he already, or who was it? The other guy that's with Stannis right now that killed a giant, right?
Godfrey Giant Slayer?
Yeah.
The clue's in the name.
Yeah. Right? It says it right there. It's pretty badass.
It is pretty badass. I like 1-1.
From now on, call me Varley the Giant Slayer.
But you didn't slay a giant.
Didn't I, Bina? You don't know what life I live.
Prove a counterfactual. Yeah, exactly. Oh, anything else on this chapter? I really thought this paired well with the epilogue. I think they were both really good State of the Nation chapters, like one for the South and one for the North. I think with the two of them, I really felt kind of like super up to date and on point with what was going on in the different factions. And it just really whetted my appetite for the next book. But I would
yeah, it was like a George compliment sandwich, like a really good chapter, a really shitty one, and then a really good chapter.
I mean, the Victorian one's not shitty. I mean, you get the Macquarie stuff, and that's pretty cool.
But, it doesn't compare in terms of, like, policy and stuff to the beginning and end of these two chapters.
But this is pretty much it now. Like, we've done with King's Landing in the last episode, and sorry, with the epilogue. And then barring the kind of the John chapters at the end, this is kind of the end of the wall in Feast. The rest of the action is now all very much in Marine. So, yeah, we really are closing out.
With Joy. Randy,
I know. But anything else on this brace of chapters?
I like Elise Carstock.
I do too. She's like, she knows what's going on. She knows that in this world she has very little actual power. But yeah, she goes to John and you're my only hope.
Yeah, yeah. She seems pretty smart for a woman, a young girl who's been through a lot. But yeah, it's a big reveal. It's a nice reveal as well.
Oh, yeah. Another thing, sorry, about her. She said that Harion, who we last saw, I think, at Harrenhal, like, walking the... Isn't he the one that was, like, he was held captive in Harrenhal?
That might be Wendell Manderly. No, you could be right, though, because there were a lot of captives held in Harrenhal in, like, A Clash of Kings.
Okay, hold on. Harion Carstark.
Because in A Feast for Crows, Jaime goes to Harrenhal and he gets the Manderly kid out of Harrenhal. That's not who you're thinking of.
After Lord Bolton takes Harrenhal, Harion is among the northern prisoners released. Roose sends him along with Robert Glover, Sir Helman Talhart, and other northerners to take Duskendale. His whereabouts after the Battle of Duskendale are unknown. Harion becomes Lord Carhold when Rob executes his father, Rickon, for treason. Oh. So we don't know where he is at all.
And that's why the Carstarks declared so strongly for Stannis as a ruse. They're hoping that the Lannisters kill him.
Yeah.
I hope he survives. I hope Elise has one brother that doesn't die.
Yeah.
And isn't an asshole. One family member that isn't a prick.
Yeah, those other two brothers deserved it, honestly. They were laughing at Bran for being a cripple.
Sons of bitches.
Well, I think I like her pragmatism. You know, she's like, well, okay, are we in a blood feud now? Because... your brother killed my father because he freed some prisoners, and it's not exactly that she doesn't care, but she's like, we're not gonna continue killing each other for centuries, that's stupid, so let's end this here. And I find that like refreshing in this world to have people who are not bloodthirsty all the time.
But weren't the Boltons and Starks in a blood feud and that ended like centuries ago and yet shit still went down? Also, is this the first time we've heard it called a blood feud in this world?
I don't know. But yeah, I'm not saying it's going to end all issues between Starks and Carstarks. It's just I like that this character is not all about vengeance. She cannot afford to be a bad vengeance, but still.
Yeah.
She also knows it's stupid.
Yeah.
Right, and I think she recognizes her family as graspers and as, you know, duplicitous people. And, you know, just, she's a good person. She's like, these people are shit.
It'll be interesting in The Winds of Winter, because I think all these uncles are getting killed. Arnulf Carstark is going to get killed. But I think Elise Carstark will be the Carstark representative in Winterfell or whatever. And we might go from the Carstarks being a bunch of shitheads to like someone we actually like. It might change our opinion of the house.
Yeah, well, I think they'll be the Carstarks from a Game of Thrones where they're like totally on board, you know, and loyal.
Okie dokie, so thanks everyone for joining. For those following along at home, the next episode of The Reread will be hosted by the lovely Queen James, and it's going to cover Tyrion 10, Dany 8, and Dany 9, as most of the action now is definitely in Essos, in which she flies away on Drogon. So, yeah, we're sort of coming to the end of the kind of a marine action as well, which is kind of scary. There will be a post-credits T-WoW discussion of Arianne 1. So you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, WordPress, all by searching for Vassals of Kingsgrave. But if you want to get involved, search for A Podcast of Ice and Fire and join the forums. So with that, thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Mary, to Adam, to Michael and Matt and Hannah. And also to Jock. And Mary. Thank you all. Sorry, that was terrible. Okie dokie, what else is everyone podcasting about? Any other any other episodes of VOC coming up?
Did Thomas give us a date for JFK2?
No, but I think it is happening at some point in December, I hope. I have lots of theories. I keep, every time I read a new book, I change my mind. So having read, I heard You Paint Houses, which is the book that The Irishman is based on, I've now completely changed my mind. And I think the mafia is hugely involved.
Well, wasn't the book Hoffa? What was it? What book about Jimmy Hoffa were you reading that you were sending?
Yeah, that was the book about Jimmy Hoffa. But the idea is that the Irishman, Frank Sheeran, who confesses to killing Jimmy Hoffa, was also the person who supplied the weapons for the Kennedy shooting and also for the Bay of Pigs fiasco. And you just realize how everyone was so involved with it that it's kind of hard to think it was that they weren't involved. I'll just leave it at that. It's a great book. It's a I would strongly recommend it. It's almost like a social history of America through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and just how complicit government, labor, unions, mafia were. It's kind of scary. Yeah.
Are we doing Mindhunter season 2?
Yeah, Matt.
Hey, there's that shit put online that I didn't do my job, but I did.
Yeah, so it's a record episode 2.
Yeah.
Let's be fair to Matt. He said last time we actually spoke about this, he said, I'm down if anyone else is down to host and edit.
Yes, that's not really being down, is it? That's just being
That's just being interested. But he said it clearly. I'm not going to host and edit this thing.
Yeah, so if anyone else wants to host and edit, they can.
Mean messages from Bina. It was a whole thing. And I would not like to go through that again.
Is anyone doing a VOC that's actually scheduled and on the books?
Nope.
No. Okay. In that case, I will bid you all goodnight because I've got 15 minutes till His Dark Materials episode 2. I would also encourage you all to watch, if you have access to Apple TV Plus, Dickinson is just beautiful and marvelous and wonderful, as is For All Mankind. So those are my recommendations.
Thank you.
Watch
I didn't get any of that.
Huh?
Did you, the News Hour? Did you watch that with Jeffrey Aniston and Reese?
Oh, the Morning Show. Yeah, that's a little
Morning
shit.
Show.
That is not good.
I will say that is like the most expensive TV show ever produced. Allegedly, it's more per episode than Game of Thrones.
Yeah, it's like 15 million an episode.
Because I guess all the money goes to the actors. I'm assuming with that. So yeah, Apple TV. I'm not going to like subscribe to another thing, but I do want to watch Dickinson. That looks looks like a lot of fun.
Well, if you get an Apple product, you get a year of it for free. So my wife owns an Apple.
If you buy a new Apple product,
yeah. So we're gonna get it for a year because my wife wants a new Apple Watch. And
also Tuesday, Disney Plus drops, and if you use code VOK, you get 0% off.
Yes, remember.
So super excited.
So, listeners, we're now going to chat a bit about the Theon chapter from TWOW, the preview chapter. So if you don't want to be spoiled about that, look away now. Okay, Matt, over to you.
Okay, so it's so satisfying, part of this chapter. So to recap, it's a Theon POV. Theon's chained to a wall and is in Stannis's whatever house he's staying in. And he's overhearing all these things, and one of the things he sees is that Stannis, you know, receives word that about the Karstark scheme. So he sends them in, and basically it's very satisfying to see them get caught in their lie. And then Stannis actually does a really cool thing and is just like, question a couple of their men, see what they knew. And then it turns out that the men didn't know anything about this, like, you know, betrayal. So the men will, it's written like the men are willing to fight for Stannis now anyway, because they didn't know that they were going to be used to help the Boltons when they were told something different completely.
Yeah, and he tells the Karstark guys, the traitorous ones, your death is certain. All that remains is the manner of it. And it's like, damn, Karstarks, you got fucked.
Well, it's like this cool build where he's like, hey, so, you know, where do your ravens go? They're like, oh, you sent out ravens, right? And they all go, they're only sent to Winterfell. Huh. So, like, who have you been talking to in Winterfell this entire time? You know, so that's how Roose knows of their movements as well. So they've been getting updates, but yeah, there's like a slow reveal, and then they try to like break out, and yeah, the guy gets his arm chopped off. It's pretty cool.
It's like a classic crime movie where they get the snitch and they like bury him in concrete or whatever. It's great.
What fuck movies are you watching?
You know, Goodfellas and stuff.